Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome. I'm a host, one of the hosts for the South Asia channel at the New Books Network. And today I'm delighted to invite for a conversation Professor Janki Buckley, who was my professor at Columbia when I was doing my master's in religion in 2003. I think that was a long time back, but very, very happy and intrigued and excited to discuss more about her fascinating book, Two Men and Music, Nationalism and the History of Indian Classical Music, published by Oxford University Press in 2005. Welcome, Professor Buckley. How are you doing in Berkeley?
Thank you. I'm very well. I'm delighted to be here.
Wonderful, wonderful. So I guess, which is customary for all authors when we invite them, we first ask them, what led you to this book, which is really a unique book, I think, to my knowledge, very rare, or probably yours is the only book that covers such an important aspect of Indian culture, Indian music, Bhatkhande and Paluskar, two giants. And we knew so little about, we know still, I think, very little about these two giants of the book. So yeah, please tell us why you chose this book and how you came to write this.
You know, why I chose to write about this is the question. Yes. You know, at the time, I think I was reading books by people like, by scholars, historians like Tapati Guha Thakurta and Partho Mittar, Much Maligned Monsters. Mm-hmm. And the study of India at the time that I was doing my PhD was very focused on what we today call post-colonialism. There was no post about it, really. We were all studying colonialism, you know, very influenced by Barney Cohen and the work of that Chicago group of scholars who were taking colonialism seriously, not just in the ways in which economic historians had done it. Mm-hmm. Economic historians who worked on, you know, the extraction of resources, things like that from India, you know, the old adage about squeezing the goodness from the Ganges and squeezing it into the Thames. But colonialism, we were interested, say my entire cohort of scholars, we were interested in colonialism and culture and the idea that you know, you could not possibly have 190 years of British colonialism and say that it had an impact on the economy, it had an impact on the way in which, you know, the Indian government was created, it had an impact on Indian education in the formation of, or in the replacement of a sort of Persian medium with English medium schools. So there was a sort of consensus that yes, colonialism had an impact on all of those kinds of material fields, yes. But there was still, for somebody like me who knew something about Hindustani classical music, who'd studied it, studied, you know, Kathak as a young girl, the idea that no, somehow in all of this, literature was influenced, okay? Our clothing was influenced, our food was influenced. Everything was influenced, but not music, not music. Somehow music had just soared over history. Now this, yeah, this was a kind of strain of thinking, or this was was something that was fairly strongly written about in ethnomusicology, that, you know, music was its own contained world. There was a Guru Shishya Parampara. There were all of these roti veti vyavhar rules that operated within gharanas. And you know, this, ye dunya alag thi. It had no connection to colonialism. And I remember thinking, this is not right. This is a kind of romantic view of Hindustani classical music. And so that was the first thing, was that how did you actually study colonialism? But you studied it where it had an effect on a major cultural tradition. And Hindustani classical music was a major cultural tradition. The second thing that I wanted to ask as a question was that if I looked at sort of the main performers of Hindustani classical music, right? And I'm looking primarily at khayal. I'm not looking at Dhrupad. I'm not looking at Dhamar. I was looking primarily at
khayal. Khayal is the most popular
now,
yes.
Right, the most popular, the one everybody associates with Hindustani classical music. Of course, the kind of gharana system was deep within khayal gaiki. That was clear. But there seemed to be, okay, and this was just looking at it from the outside, Pankaj. It wasn't exactly like I'd done any research on this, right? But it seemed there was a kind of transition that late from the 18th into the 19th centuries, the main musicians were all primarily Muslim men. And then the musicians are not, okay, that it's almost taken over, if you will, by a new group, and that's almost entirely, not exclusively. I don't mean by this to say that there were no Bengali Muslim, Bengali musicians or South Indian Muslim musicians, but there was a dominance, there was a predominance of Marathi musicians, right? Kesarbhai Kerkar to Gangubai Hangal, onwards, all the way to Bhimsen Joshi, to, you know, to all of the stalwarts. So many, more than I could, to Kishori Amonkar. And there was a kind of transition. So there was this music that was affiliated or associated with a kind of past which was seen as not quite suitable for national consumption. It was connected either to the princely court or it was connected to the kotha. And vaha se jaake, it all becomes, it was sort of embodied for me in the ways in which, you know, even somebody like Kishori Amonkar, or where, you know, you had the sari pallu drawn around both shoulders, okay, a juda. And maybe particular kinds of seven diamond earring, and then that music was, and I wanted to track that transformation. I wanted to ask how that happened. I wanted to say, how is it possible that this happened? This is a historical transformation. This is not a seamless transformation. Really, how does it happen that it moves like this? And so that was the second thing. And the third thing was that in what I was reading about Hindustani classical music, people focused entirely, with good reason, Dan Newman, Regula Qureshi. There was a whole generation of, Regula Qureshi actually doesn't work on khayal, she works on qawwali. But all of the ethnomusicologists focused entirely on the musician, just the musician, right? And whatever the musician said, they accepted it. You know, trained in history, you're skeptical about all of your sources, all of your sources, right? Every single one. And you're certainly skeptical where if you were to ask me, you know, what was the truth about music, I would actually in turn expect you to be skeptical about my answer, because I would be giving you an answer entirely from my perspective and bias and so on and so forth. So those were the ways in which I thought, all right, I'll get into music and track this transformation. There were other sort of questions for me. You know, Maharashtra is the home of the RSS, the home of the Shiv Sena. The very strong politics there. What happened to those politics when it came to music? Did they stay? Did they go away? If they went away, did they, you know, return? So there were all these kinds of strands that led me into the study of music. And in studying music, it struck me that, you know, the two major modernizers of music, but modernizers in different directions.
Yes.
Different directions.
Very interesting. Yeah. Yes.
Meant that, you know, even that concept of the modern Hindustani classical music, you know, Bhatkhande was taking it in a very different direction than Palusar was. All right.
And so
that's how I got into it.
Mm-hmm.
I can talk about this without stopping. I should stop and let you ask me the question.
That's an exciting topic that, you know, we can have a long conversation, but for our readers' benefit, I want to appetize them to, you know, intrigue them to read your book. So I guess my first, I mean, again, these are big questions and we can easily have a long, but in really brief, I'm asking a big question. How exactly, if you can succinctly summarize for audience, I will have four or five major questions, but next question is, how exactly do you think, you can summarize very quickly, this colonialism, how it influenced Indian classic? We know that Bollywood music is all influenced by cosmopolitan, Western music and all, but Indian classical music was influenced by colonialism. That's such an you know, intriguing and, yeah, so please, you know, unpack a little bit.
Well, you know, I went to the India Office records and I looked at all of the ways in which early colonial administrators described music,
from William.
Okay, and who were the people who did this? So why was it even that it came to notice, right? Why was Hindustani classical music even coming to notice?
Yeah.
And in so many ways, what you could find in the archive was a colonial denigration of native music, right? A colonial denigration of native music. Whatever it was that the natives were doing, they were calling it caterwauling. There were military surveyors who were hearing this music saying this sounds just like a kind of screeching, if you will, you know, absent of any discipline, absent of melody. And then the biggest thing about it was that coming out of a kind of, shall we say, a musical tradition which went, you know, from Bach to Mozart to Beethoven, right? Mm-hmm. Where music, in order to be classical, had to be written down. Mm-hmm. And that the ability to read music off the page was the marker of a kind of classical musical training. Mm-hmm. But that didn't work in India. That didn't work with classical music, yes. Right? Your entire rag is sung in two couplets. There's the sthayi, there's the antara, and the rest of it is not. So you could see, for instance, when I started doing research on Bhatkhande and Paluskar, that in their works, they were saying, Thika, you know, if you want Hindustani classical music, in order to be considered classical music, you need it to be written, we'll write it. You know, write it, all right?
There was some debate about the idea.
Huh. And it wasn't, you think an orchestra is the epitome? We'll find an orchestra for you. Here's an orchestra, right? Now, orchestration, as it turns out, does enter music, right? I mean, all of those like slightly, shall I say, passionate violence, like 18 violins in each one of these, in the, right? I mean, that does enter it, yeah.
Yes.
But what I was trying to do, Pankaj, in the book was also show that what becomes Hindustani classical music, what you and I studied, what I studied certainly, did not emerge sort of unbroken from the Natya Shastra to the present. Acha? Which is how we imagined it.
Right, exactly.
But that it comes into its own as a kind of classical music, a music that a national term
Indian
can be attached.
Right.
So there was Western classical music and Chinese classical music. And, you know, now you have an Indian classical music, which starts out, of course, not as Indian, but Hindustani classical music. That comes about because in some ways of a response on the part of modernizers like Bhatkhande and Paluskar, and they were two that I picked. There were others, right? There are others in Bengal. Rabindranath Tagore, for instance, is hugely instrumental in producing a different kind of music in Bengal. But it comes about in part because there there is a kind of desire on the part of at least these two men to respond to this kind of colonial denigration, right? And in that kind of interaction, you can say colonialism had an impact, because you don't see that kind of, you know, intense desire to systematize, categorize, write down, produce a curriculum, produce exams, Sangeet Visharad, so on and so forth, right? You didn't have this. Yes. You don't have this earlier. You don't have an academy. You don't have conferences. You don't have, it's off a piece with this other kind of drive, not just in Maharashtra, but elsewhere as well. The kind of intensity with which you can see, for instance, in the same period, histories being written, you know, dictionaries being compiled, encyclopedias being compiled, right?
Amazing.
And Dharma Shastras, the whole idea that there is a kind of knowledge that we need to recover in some ways, or we need, we don't just...
We'll keep this.
And so then you have volume after volume after volume after volume of these kinds of works being produced. Why are they being produced? It would be just simply wrong to say that they were not being produced in response to a kind of engagement with colonialism, right? Whether it was colonial patronizing, or whether it was colonial denigration, or whether it was colonial appreciation, right? And there are features of all three, three.
So and William Jones probably would, we can keep an appreciation, right? Or
you could certainly, without a doubt, you could put William Jones in that category. But even William Jones's appreciation was still under the sort of umbrella of colonialism.
Right, of course.
So partly, Pankaj, my book was saying, you know, why do we need music to be ahistorical?
Okay.
Why are you so frightened of history? It's like, you know, it doesn't, it's, you know, it's, why are you frightened of history? Was, you know, I'm saying this while I'm thinking about it.
Yes.
It isn't really how I set about it, but it was just to sort of say, look, Hindustan, all classical music.
Always evolving tradition, like other traditions.
They evolve, it's an evolving tradition, yeah. And, you know, in some cases it evolves in these weird ways. And that was why colonialism, right? Because I was also arguing against the ethnomusicologists, and I was arguing against the Indologists. And I was arguing against the Indologists in some ways because for the Indologists, the text was adequate. The text, you know, if you had a text like the Natya Shastra,
but the converted spinal, yes.
There's nothing about rag in the Natya Shastra. There's nothing about performance in the Natya Shastra. It's a prescriptive treatise. It's written in Sanskrit. Musicians weren't reading it. Musical performers weren't reading it. I mean, you know, it's only later that in, you know, in the period that I was working on, that the Natya Shastra is pulled out again. And then somebody like Bhatkhande discovers that the Natya Shastra is of no use. No use. That he did not need an ancient history, right? He needed an old history, but not an ancient one.
Right.
So that's why it went to colonialism.
Yeah. I guess my next question would be that exact name, Bhatkhande, Vishnu Bhatkhande. How exactly he was like traveling all across India and interviewing all these musicians. So yeah, you please tell us, summarize what Bhatkhande, what exactly he did. He seems like so much energy, he's traveled so much.
Tremendous energy. You know, I came out of the project. I'd actually started out, you know, I knew enough about Paluskar, right? Because he was a kirtankar, and so I knew about all of that.
Oh, by the way, on Paluskar, I'll come to the next question, but let's talk about it. On Paluskar, I was going to ask you, you didn't mention his sons. Did his son also play a role on all this? So his son
didn't
was also a great performer.
Yeah. It was, you know, the scope of the book was such that I actually was hoping that what it would do would be to encourage others to work on all of the figures that I could not work on, that I had not worked on, you know, because it came out of a dissertation. It's too much. There was too much. You know, I wanted to do the Gandharva Mahavidyalaya, and then I wanted to do first something on the princely courts, because that was the transition. So for instance, I didn't do a lot in this book with Natya Sangeet, which was an obvious kind of transitional.
Yes.
in Marathi Natya Sangeet. I didn't write that much about Marathi Natya Sangeet.
Right.
And I wanted, because I wanted a kind of historical trajectory for the book, right? And
Bhatkhande
was so fascinating for me, you know, because and it's interesting because Bhatkhande now, the work that I'm doing now, the second book that I'm writing on Savarkar, I've been reading so much by sort of the Marathi intellectuals of the 10s and 20s and 30s and about, you know, various figures in Maharashtra. Rahul Sarvate has actually an excellent dissertation on the intellectual history of Maharashtra on this period. You know, you should have him on your interview him as well. He's got a job teaching it at Ahmedabad, but he would be able to tell you so much more about this. Prachi Deshpande's work, of course. But it is a period of this kind of recovery. And Bhatkhande is so firmly of the opinion that there is a kind of pokal panditya, what he calls pokal panditya. Pokal is hollow. And hollow panditya.
Ponga panditya. North India, we say ponga panditya.
Pokal panditya. Yeah. It's a hollow, it's almost like pedantry, right? Pedantic knowledge. And to stay away from that kind of pokal panditya and to actually get to the meat of the music itself, and the meat of the music itself were the various compositions, and the compositions were all kept hidden, and they were all sort of completely tied up by this gharana system. And so you see this this struggle between that as well, between the gharana system and Bhatkhande. And if you wanted to know somebody else who's written a book on this, is Dharat Newman, who's Dan Newman's son. Newman was a much older generation.
Dan Newman, I knew, but I didn't know.
And Dard has written, his name is Dard. He's also a sitar player who Shujat Khan's shagird, I think. And Dard Newman is at UC Santa Cruz. And he wrote a book about this too. So in fact, if you wanted the other side of my book, which was the resistance to everything somebody like Bhatkhande and Paluskar were trying to do from the gharanas itself, you should go to Dharat Newman.
Okay.
And so, I mean, I can tell you that if you wanted to do a whole series on music, that's where you should go. And then if you wanted to do Carnatic music, there are at least two people. There's Lakshmi Subramaniam, who wrote about the Madras Musical Academy, and Amy Weidman. Who wrote about sort of the ways in which a kind of modern instrumentality comes into music, like the harmonium is hugely resisted, as you can imagine, right?
Because it's accordion ka chota, if younger version of accordion, harmonium.
That's right. And then Marathi Natya Sangeet is unthinkable without the accordion, without the harmonium now,
harmonium,
right?
Yes.
So, but Bhatkhande is sort of part of this generation that is indefatigable. Say, so Prachi Deshpande writes about Rajwade, for instance, right? Who was so bent on sort of gathering as much archival material as he possibly could, recognizing that some of this archival material was going to reside in homes, in people's homes, and he would go there and he would just sort of demand the material. And if they didn't get it, he would say, you know, I will return again and again and again until you give me this.
So and he would go on streets and just ask for the names of the musician in that town, and he'll just gather all the information. Every street is going and just collecting all this material.
So there's a really intense kind of drive to gather, collect, much more, Pankaj, than even I knew when I was writing the book, because since then I've been doing other kinds of reading. And this kind of almost, I don't want to use the word frenzy, that's not the word that I want to use, but there is a really intense drive to accumulate and to restore, and for several purposes, all right? One is simply to sort of catalog all of this work. The other is to examine the work. Third is to write a certain kind of historical narrative. Fourth is to sort of inculcate in a new generation the virtue of actually doing this kind of empirical work. And in retrospect, I see Bhatkhande as part of that kind of impetus.
Yes.
But of course, But the inevitable clash with the community of musicians, right? Mm. For whom the perpetuation of a tradition was mm-hmm. that it was handed down within the family, within a sort of genealogy from, you know. And then Bhatkhande's attempt to take it away from them and turn it into something national. So you see musicians then caught between, say, that kind of impulse on Bhatkhande's part, and then Pandit Paluskar's, which was much more driven by his own personal kind of religiosity. You know, I'm older, I'm much older than I was when I wrote the book. So arguably I might've written it slightly differently, but it's clear that for Pandit Paluskar, you know, music could not be separated from a kind of spirituality,
and nationalism.
Yeah. And whereas for Bhatkhande, it was much more, at least what we would understand as a kind of Gandhian secularism, yeah. I think, right? Yeah, which is you mean. Just that you just got it and converted it into a kind of curriculum and a training that was available for all, but it had to be rigid and it had to be scholarly and it had to be, you know, you could never have done it the way Bhatkhande did it. You would need 5-6 languages, you know, in order to do it properly. But Bhatkhande is quite extraordinary in his energy. And what is interesting is that one of the arguments that I was making in the book was that somehow, even as Bhatkhande is successful, all right, and when I say, I don't mean to pose them as complete success and failure, Bhatkhande as failure, Paluskar as successful. I think I did that in the book, you know, at the time, it was a device, if you will, literary kind of device in which to do it. But it was striking to me that at the end of all of this, you know, what emerges as Hindustani classical music is completely removes itself or is removed in the kind of conversation between Bhatkhande and Paluskar, who did not like each other. Okay, Paluskar did not think Bhatkhande was a real musician. Okay, and there was all of that sort of, on the one hand, shall we say, a musician's distaste for a non-musician writing history. And on the other hand, there was Bhatkhande's position about musicians who can't see anything, you know, they can't look 2 days into the future. They just see just their own performance, but they don't see the bigger picture.
Right.
And so I meant to produce this kind of dialectic between them that produces Hindustani classical music.
Right.
But what was very striking for me, Pankaj, was that, you know, both of them in their own way try to remove music from the debauchery of the princely court, the indolence of the princely court.
Mm-hmm.
While the musicians are saying, "Arre, in the princely courts, wo ek zamana tha, jo, you know, ye maharaja aake, you know, dhoop mein khade reh ke 4 ghante hamara gana suna karte the."
That is all like gone.
Achha, wo saari baate, you know, and to that end, music was so removed from anything related to the body, that it was turned almost asexualized, right? Mm. And that was my chance, you know, that was the kind of transformation I was tracking, like from bai to tai almost, right? Where it's like the body, and because of that, you know, this idea that it has to be completely spiritual, you know, you have to bow to everything, you know, you bow to your instruments, pranam karte karte karte, you know, everything starts with a prayer. That was my sort of critical note at the end of that book, which was that it has, you know, in some ways, one group was moved out of center stage and another group was moved into center stage. But in the process, you know, what happened to music? And, you know, that was something I was hoping other students would pick up and write.
So I guess so. Bhatkhande's then main contribution is to intellectualize the entire system, come up with notations and all the intellectual work. Now let's come to Paluskar. What was his major contribution? And then we'll discuss how they both merged in the contemporary set of Contemporary.
You know, they didn't merge. No, they were antagonists, and they never did merge per se. I think Hindustani classical music is landed up creating a merger between them.
Exactly, that's what I meant. That we,
you know,
in the contemporary setting, we have Gandharva Vidyalaya, but we also use notations of Bhatkhandi. So kind of
Bhatkhandi, yes.
Somehow they both merged. The systems merged, irrespective of the founders of the both systems.
Yeah. You know, partly I think that is Paluskar's success, all right? And that is why I was saying that he was successful, right? Okay. Because in everything that I read, you know, on Paluskar, from Paluskar or from the people who wrote about Paluskar, Paluskar styled himself a particular way, right? Uh-huh. And I think you can see that, you can see it with Gandhi, that he styles himself in a particular way. If you looked at, say, the transformation of Gandhi from his time in London as a student, where he's wearing a top hat and a striped tie and, you know, double-breasted jacket, all the way to when he is wearing just a loincloth. And he's wearing a loincloth because a peasant in Tamil Nadu tells him that, you know, khadi is too expensive and a loincloth is all he can afford, right? And so that is the reason that Gandhi then will move to wearing only that loincloth, which of course produces its own thing. Like, you know, people in India at the time are horrified. Why is he wearing a loincloth? Why is he not wearing more clothes? What is this, you know? Or he goes off to England wearing very few clothes and is asked by a reporter, you know, do you think you were wearing enough clothes? To which his response is that he thought the king was wearing more than enough for both of them. And so, but what I mean by this is that, you know, I wanted to pay attention to the self-fashioning of Paluskar, that Paluskar fashions himself in a certain way, right? As somebody who had visions, as somebody who heard things, who was pulled by a spiritual religiosity, very devout, and that music had to be part of that, that music had to be
miracles, hagiographical details, the miracles by Paluskar.
Yeah.
And move mountains and
you know, which is a very, very different way of approaching music the way Bhatkhandi approached it, right? Bhatkhandi wanted it
totally
in some ways. An intellectual mod. And, you know, honestly, I mean, when, for instance, you know, I remember going to a Pandit Jasraj concert. And Pandit Jasraj came dressed almost like in a garb of a sadhu, right? In the colors. Sort of blessed, almost blessed the audience, right? That's a very different kind of performance, shall we say, right? Than a performance in which, that does not happen.
Right.
In which the musician, you know, comes in, just says namaskar as by way of saying hello,
right?
And settles down, and then, you know, makes sure tanpuras are correctly tuned, that the tabla tone is correct, and then starts singing or whatever. It's a very different atmosphere that is produced, right? It's a very, very different atmosphere that's produced. And at the end of my book, I felt like, you know, Bhatkhande's vision had taken a beating a little bit, and that Paluskar's had prevailed, right? In the sort of ascription, shall we say, or the joining of this kind of spirituality, religiosity, with Hindustani classical music. But Bhatkhande, that was not Bhatkhande's wish. And some fusion of the two then comes about, because Bhatkhande had the more...
The notations are all used by Western
Bhatkhande. Yeah, it comes about. To my mind, it's to music's detriment.
Okay.
To my mind, that is to dance's detriment, right? I think you could see it, say, for me, in Kathak, for instance, where, I mean, how many times were we going to dance Makhan Chori? I mean, was there no subject that we could dance other than that? Was there nothing we could do that was not either in, you know, there was not Draupadi Haran or Makhan Chori, or was there nothing that we could dance that was released, or in some ways, not, you know, there was a whole world, right, of emotions, passions, stories that could be told that did not need to be confined just to, you know, the two epics that occupied such a large role. And
that sort of froze
music and froze arts for a little while. Now, actually, it's different. Now I think it's different. But it's, you know, that's historical process, I guess. It takes a while.
So, even actually in the film history, we see earlier silent films were all about mythology and epics and so on.
Yeah.
Now they moved on to all kinds of subjects in films.
Yeah.
Probably something similar.
It was and remains, I think, frustrating for a number of dancers and musicians that it's just, you can't get out of this. You can't get out of it. You don't get a grant if you're not writing something about yet another reversion of, you know, Draupadi Haran, or, you know, because so much is dependent on it.
Oh.
And you see, so there's a whole, independent of this, there's a whole structure that keeps this in place. And so that was where I felt like, you know, when I saw Pandit Jasraj bless his audience, I thought, well, this is Paluskar's success. This is Paluskar's success. The idea that, you know, Hindustani classical music must always be tied to, in some sense, sacrality, religiosity, spirituality.
So Paluskar was the one, I mean, pioneer of all these Gandharva Mahavidyalaya spread across India now, right? He was the one who started. You think how many such vidyalayas, such schools are there across India now for teaching classical
music? Right now? I would not know. Right now, I would not know. And one of my big regrets is that I did not actually go to Lahore until much later to look at where the original Gandharva Mahavidyalaya was. You know, I found a lot.
I thought he closed down and then he moved to Maharashtra.
Yeah, but it was originally set up in Lahore.
Now, do you think maybe hundreds of thousands, do you think? These music schools.
Oh, yes. Without a doubt. Hundreds of thousands.
Canada, everywhere, all over the world.
Everywhere. Yeah. I don't follow what happens in the US and Canada so much with the music. I mean, I just listen to the music itself. But did you see Chaitanya Tamhane's movie called The Disciple?
No, not yet. I will watch
it. So you should watch that, because a lot of that is sort of, you know, when I was looking, I watched that movie, I thought, oh my gosh, somebody here seems to have read my book. You know, because it is a kind of description of a kind of world that does not concede to the forces of change. And it's described in very loving detail, but with a very good critical eye. And by critical, I don't mean politically critical. I mean critical as in seeing this world of music almost as this sealed world, hermetically sealed world, you know, where you enter it with your Guruji, and then you and the Guruji's other Shishas are like this unit. And then you're moving around within that unit, whereas the forces of the world are knocking on the door, and you only see the forces of the world as somehow polluting, corrupting. So if one of your students wants to go off and join a band, for instance, well, then he can join the band, but he can never come back to learn music with me. Those kinds of absolutisms, you know, that I think in some ways have to be fought against, because otherwise art form doesn't grow.
It should keep evolving and not afraid of
it. In my opinion, it should. But of course, you know, I'm not a musician, and I don't have. I don't have the same kind of investment in maintaining the tradition as it was, because for me, you know, a tradition is always historical. I mean, it is what, you know, whatever the tradition is.
Evolving,
you and I having this conversation is not something that could have happened 50 years ago.
Right?
It's a good thing that we're having it. Yeah.
Did I miss anything major that you would like to add?
You know, the thing is about the book, what I will say is that there were certain arguments that I wanted to make. One was that music was not just modernized, but music becomes a modernizing tool itself.
Oh, okay.
And by that I meant that music becomes the kind of way in which if you can see now, right, what happens when you get married and you have children? Well, your daughter is immediately put into either Kathak or Bharatanatyam or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. It's no longer that, you know, you wait to find out whether she has the talent and then you hand her over to a guru or something like that, right? That music becomes a modernizing tool in educating, if you will, a new generation of Indians into their quote unquote national culture. But
so it's
in the
nationalizing and traditionalizing also then, right?
Nationalizing and traditionalizing go together.
Right.
And the other couple of arguments that I wanted to make, one was, of course, that one group of women were moved out of the center stage, right? These were your Akhtari Bais who become then Begum Akhtar, right? So one group is moved out, one group of women is moved out, women who were considered too attached to a kind of debauched or a sensuous, a sexual world. And another group of women is moved in, right? And they're all, now they are all chaste and asexual and sort of cleansed. The music is cleansed of all of its past associations.
Spiritually, kind of, yeah.
Yeah. And in the process, I mean, one of the arguments that I did make was that that even the kind of, shall we say, Hindu theory that was put on this music, right, even that was, shall we say, struggled over. So whereas for somebody like Paluskar, right, without real engagement with or study of, right, of any Sanskrit texts or anything or part of Hindu history, there was this kind of assumption ki, you know, ye bahut purana hai, ye hamesha se chala raha hai. But for somebody like
Bhattacharya,
from the Vedas to now, straight line, okay. But for somebody like Bhatkhande, what was much more interesting was that he tried to do that and he found that it could not hold up historically. So you had that kind of historical, critical, and yet nationalist, and yet modernizing, and yet, right, all of that. And it's in that kind of struggle that you see the emergence of, you see the emergence of Hindustani classical music. But and I ended it with Abdul Karim Khan and his daughter for that reason. You know, where
I really
like
the incident that you about Abdul Karim Khan, the first time he announces the name of the raga and there is a ruckus. How can you announce the name of the raga?
I know.
That was so
you do not announce it, you know. So, samajhdar, everyone who knows the music knows it automatically.
Samajh jao, you should
know. Haan, bilkul, apne aap samajh jao. Aur agar samajh nahi wale ho, to niklo tum yahan se, you know, kya kaam hai tumhara yahan? But the other thing that I wanted to do in the book, Pankaj, was that one of the things that I heard, and partly I heard it from musicians, I heard, you know, ek zamana hua karta tha, maharaja unka zamana, ye wo, ye wo, ye wo. And so that's when I went off to Baroda. When I sat there and I made my way through all of those Huzur Hukum Namas, you know, there was a Kalavant Karkhana along with other Karkhanas. You know, music was with half the time that the musicians were saying, you know, this Maharaja came back from here and stood in the rain and, you know, and listened to me singing Malhar and so on and so forth. Those Maharajas were barely there. Wo to the nahi. They were... garmi ke mahine mein they went off to England. Acha, they bought homes in London and they spent their time there. So there was, so how did you understand this nostalgia on the part of the musicians? Because it was a nostalgia for, I'm not saying that there were no Maharajas who were not music aficionados, but you know, the ideal shrota or the ideal ideal patron, right, was a patron who just sort of gave a musician a home and money and just let him, you know, sort of further his musical ambitions and further his art. that this was more wishful thinking than actuality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that this was perhaps an indicator of what the musicians might have wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very rare. In mm-hmm. most cases, that was not the case. They mm-hmm. weren't treated quite that well.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways, you know, Bhatkhande's efforts would have professionalized the entire community mm. of musicians differently, right? Mm. Established academies.
It's almost like a revolution that he started. Both of these together, it's like a revolution. Yeah. These mushrooming yeah. thousands so of
schools. Yes, but to hear it from the point of view of the musicians, you should invite Garth Newman, okay? Because for the musicians themselves, sitting in the gharanas, watching all of this, on the one hand, watching Paluskar say, look, your music is all this is a Hindu music. You know, you were basically taking gharanas and saying, you are not authors of your own art. You're just the performers of an art that preceded
that
you.
Attention, yes.
Huh. And that on the one hand, and then on the other, to see somebody like Bhatkhande treat them as if they were just, you know, ignorant and almost as if, you know, aap log ga sakte hai, iske alawa aur kuch nahi kar sakte, you know, na likh sakte, na pad sakte, na kuch nahi kar sakte, you know, na kama sakte, na kuch nahi kar sakte. And you need to hand over all your compositions to me, me, Bhatkhande, when I'm not a musician myself.
Hmm.
Not a musician, but I will nonetheless set it all up in an academy, you know. Hmm. So musicians get caught. And that's if I were to be critical of my own book, I would say that dimension I did not include.
Oh, okay, the other side.
You know? Right. Huh. So you I did not include
now. We have a counterpart now. So.
I have a counterpart, and Dard did, all right. But but I was very focused on how music was nationalized and how it was turned into a national tradition.
Super. So I think we could have talked more, but I think for the interest of audience, we
only
spoke 50 minutes. And really, really fascinating book, path-breaking book from my perspective. I think I don't know of any other book that does such a wonderful, concise, and precise summary of modern history of Indian classical music and how these two giants revolutionized the musical scene with all the tensions and biases and whatnot. Thank you so much, Professor Buckley. You were my professor once, and now I learned again so much from you. And
well, I hope this was useful for you and for your listeners. And I will come to Pune, and Pune is, where I have a lot of family. And, I'll come look you up.
Most welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.